Hey, album nerds. Before we dive in, we want to acknowledge the tragic passing of Mastodon guitarist and vocalist Brent Hinds. This episode was recorded before the news broke, and our thoughts are with his family, the band, and all the fans mourning this loss. And now back to our regularly scheduled programming.
Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Don and Dude.
Georgia. It's the Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got Don with me. We are continuing our trip across these 50 states, bands across America.
Bands across America!
You ready to tackle Georgia, my friend?
Oh, yes. I'm ready!
That was very, very flamboyant. Well done. So this is the Album Nerds Podcast. We love albums and the album format. And this summer, we've been traveling across these United States, discovering albums from everyone we visit. We've got a great show for you. As I mentioned, we are headed to Georgia. So each of us will be presenting an album from an artist or band from Georgia. Don's going to ask us a deep question. Then we'll have some shout-outs to some other albums and album-related items we're digging, new releases, etc. And unfortunately, we are bringing this trip across America to a close as the summer comes to a close, but we're making one more stop, and we'll talk about that at the end of the show. But this week, it's all about Georgia.
Road trip!
That's what I'm talking about!
Welcome to Georgia, the Peach State, where musical roots run deep and Southern spirit shines bright. From the gospel and blues traditions that echo through Macon and Augusta to Atlanta's pioneering hip-hop sound, Georgia's influence on American music is unmistakable. Wander historic Savannah squares, hike the scenic Blue Ridge Mountains, and savor the flavor and warmth that makes Georgia's culture truly unforgettable.
Can never go wrong with savor the flavor.
Yes.
So some of the flavors we savored in the music world as we went through this rather large list of different artists to choose from. I'll just mention a few. There are too many to really list out here, but James Brown, soul funk R&B pioneer. Little Richard, potentially the true founder of rock and roll. Ray Charles, soul R&B. The Allman Brothers Band, although, you know, also they have Florida roots as well. In the hip-hop world, Outkast, probably one of the more influential of the last couple of decades in terms of reshaping how hip-hop sounded. Yep. REM, alternative rock, they helped shape what alternative radio and alternative music became. Gladys Knight and the Pips. Travis Tritt, here's a quarter called Someone Who Cares, love it. Alan Jackson, It's 5 o'clock Somewhere. Jason Aldean, Luke Bryan, Zac Brown Band, all huge country artists. Brenda Lee.
She was rocking around the Christmas tree.
Yes, she was. That's the only thing I know that she did, but still worth mentioning. And then, you know, there's other hip-hop artists like Migos, Future, 21 Savage, more recent, the Indigo Girls. Hmm? And then a little more on the fringes, Widespread Panic, an Athens jam band. Hmm. A lot to consider and a lot we didn't mention, but we're ready to go. We've got the albums queued up. The tank is full and Georgia's ahead of us. Let's roll out with our cha-cha-cha choices.
You choose me?
All right, let's hop in our Chrysler that's as big as a whale.
It's about to set sail.
My pick is from 1989, the B-52's Cosmic Thing.
So on brand.
Yes. So the B-52s were formed in Athens, Georgia in 1976. The original lineup was Fred Schneider, Kate Pearson, Cindy Wilson, and her brother Ricky Wilson, and Keith Strickland. In 1985, Ricky Wilson passed away from AIDS. And this is the first album they recorded since he passed away. Okay. Ricky Wilson and Keith Strickland were actually kind of the main musical, like instrumental forces in the band. And so I think Keith Strickland ended up taking on more guitar duties. And, you know, I think was the main composer of at least the musical aspects of these songs.
So prior to this, were they best known for Rock Lobster, probably?
Yeah. And then, I mean, on college radio, you might have heard like Private Idaho,
yeah, or
Planet Claire.
Okay.
But yeah, Rock Lobster was probably their, you know, most known tune at that time. So yeah, they got, you know, massive producers on this one. So both Nile Rodgers and Don Was contributed their expertise. Let's listen to the first track of the album, the title track, Cosmic Thing.
You know, my experience alone in a room listening to this album while I worked, hearing Shake Your Honey Buns and realizing that I was.
Yeah,
I didn't mean to.
It just happens.
It just happens.
So Cosmic Thing is, you know, kind of a funk-driven, upbeat opener. Very similar to Love Shack, which we'll talk about later. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like many of their songs, I think it's kind of just losing yourself in joy and dance or whatever. But kind of, you know, the typical call-and-response vocals. So you have the two ladies, Kate Pearson and Cindy Wilson, and then Fred Schneider, who often repeats, you know, something that they said.
Or, yeah.
Yeah, you know, just a fun song and, you know, sort of sets the pace for the album.
Yeah.
So I think because they were kind of mourning the loss of their friend and, you know, trying to get through that, I think this album and writing it was sort of therapeutic.
Catharsis.
Yeah, I think they deliberately, you know, tried to, you know, provide joy.
Yeah. I mean, there's those, the guitars are very shimmery. There's something beachy about this. Mm. I mean, it brings to mind like those beach movies from the 60s somehow. Yeah. But in it with the 80s sheen and flavor, but the vocals are so eccentric, like from all angles, not just Fred's, but the ladies as well. There's something otherworldly, alien about it somehow.
It is. Yeah, it's weird because it is, I mean, it's pop, you know, and it's accessible, but it's also weird in some way.
Alternative and pop art in other ways, yeah. It almost feels like it's tongue-in-cheek, but it isn't.
Yeah. Yeah, they live in that kind of kitsch world.
They have beehive hairdos and stuff like that. But it definitely sets the album's tone, right? I mean, it tells you we're going to try and forget our troubles.
All right, well, let's move on to another cut. This comes later in the album. And this one is really their first attempt at like an overtly political song.
It's the heaviest it gets, I think. And it's not particularly heavy, but.
Here's Channel Z. Yeah, this is kind of grown into like my favorite B-52 song. I think just because it has a little more heaviness to it. The song kind of crescendos. It gets more intense. There's like this vocal break towards the end, and you know he's shouting out things and they're singing other words, but then like he gets like almost angry at the end. He's like, take this information and throw it in the shredder. You know, so that's like angry Fred Schneider. So it gets pretty intense, but it looks like it's kind of critiquing the mass media, and it mentions, you know, like environmental decline and kind of the late 80s or the Reagan America and, you know, Thatcher Britain, you know, that era.
So Channel Z, kind of like whether it's radio or television, is like the media buzz that's constantly.
Yeah, just noise. That's not really helping us, you know.
What if they had experienced TikTok? I wonder what the song would be like then.
Yeah. But, you know, I like the funky guitar. It almost sounds like Nile Rodgers.
Oh, he's definitely in there.
You know what? Like, if you look at the tracks that Don Was did and the ones that Nile Rodgers produced, they're not the ones you would think. So this is a Don Was.
Could be influence of working with them, because I feel like Don Was and Nile Rodgers have distinctly different, typically, sounds, and this album is pretty consistent in its sound. So I feel like there was a symbiosis where the B-52s were being the B-52s and then taking what they learned from these producers and making it their own. Yeah, it's cool. It's a cool sound.
Yeah, and this, I mean, I like that they do, you know, kind of go to darker places on the album. It's not all just, you know, fun and games.
Right, but like you said, Fred It sounds fun no matter what it is.
Yeah.
It's like millions of people are being murdered. Like, okay. Sounds fun.
All right, well, was there a track you wanted to highlight?
I wanted to highlight two because they're the only two I had heard really before listening to this album for this episode.
You're always bending the rules.
I do like to bend the rules. But at the time, I sort of thought they were the same song. So why don't we kick it off with a little bit of Love Shack, as we mentioned earlier. Glitter on the front porch, glitter on the highway. I think that line alone describes what this song is all about.
Yeah.
But it's funky, celebratory. I guess it's a dance anthem. But I guess it was inspired by an actual cabin that they used to hang out at or something. Is that?
Yeah, I think even I had read that songs like Rock Lobster and Private Idaho were, you know, crafted in that,
okay,
you know, in that place, in that shack. But then I think there was some club as well that they're also kind, okay, of referencing.
Yeah, and musically it's very slinky. That guitar riff, it's got some cowbell. Yeah.
I got a fever, and the only prescription is more cowbell.
Bubbling bass line, and it blends new wave with sort of a free jam band energy. And Fred Schneider's talk singing, that was the first time I remember really hearing it. I don't think I heard Rock Lobster until after this. Mm. And I was just like, what the hell is this? You know? But it's, yeah, it's an anthem of unity and just having fun in a safe space, you know?
Yeah. When I hear this, like if I'm at a wedding or something, this is usually like the song that'll get me on the floor. I don't know. There's something about the song. Just I like to shake my cosmic thing.
Yes, you do. The other song I wanted to mention as well was Rome, which is probably the other big hit off the record. Let's listen to a little bit of that one. This one's a little more melodic than Love Shack, featuring more of the lush harmonies of Cindy and Kate. Jangly guitars, shimmering keyboards. I think where I find them very similar is it's another uplifting song that kind of represents freedom and adventure and living life to its fullest, trying to put the bad stuff aside and just celebrate life. And I think, yeah, both of those songs do that. And I think that's probably why they connected with listening audience at the time.
Yeah, I agree. If you listen to just the instrumental track, it kind of sounds like one of the poppier R.E.M. songs. Yeah. You know, it's got the, like you said, it's got the jangly guitar. Kind of sounds like Shiny Happy People.
Yeah, it does.
So this is the one song where they actually have some outside help from writing. I guess the lyrics were by somebody named Robert Waldrop. And, you know, I could not find any information about how they ended up collaborating with him or anything. But All right, well, let's go to the final track. This is Follow Your Bliss.
Not sure what to make of this.
Yeah, so it's an instrumental track composed by Keith Strickland, also by Sarah Lee, who plays bass on most of the tracks. You know, they had farmed out their rhythm section basically. Also, Spencer Campbell plays drums on a bunch of tracks as well. Who's in Duran Duran for a minute?
This sounds kind of Duran-y.
Yeah. So the track sequence is supposed to be like a film, kind of moving from rural themes to more abstract concepts. And then this instrumental coda, I think, is supposed to be like the credit sequence, which kind of, I can kind of feel that now.
I was going to say, this sounds to me like from a late 80s fantasy movie. There's something fantastical about it somehow. And it does kind of flow off of the track before it, Topaz.
Yep.
So I think I thought it was just the continuation of Topaz. I didn't realize it was its own track. But I think for this song, the title is where the message is.
Mm-hmm.
Follow Your Bliss. And I think that's how they're trying to close the album. They don't need to say it. I think they're setting a stage for you to do it yourself.
Yeah.
That's what it felt like to me. Once I realized it was its own track and I looked at the title, I'm like, oh yeah, time to reflect on all of that. Maybe rewind and reflect.
Yes. Well, let's do that. All right. Well, I'll start off with my clickbait headline. something good can happen when these cosmic things invade our turntables. So, I mean, the B-52s were kind of always on my radar, and I had a friend who had this cassette, but I don't think I ever owned it myself. I've always kind of liked the B-52s, and I've seen them live, but this is the first time I really kind of dug into an album, and I really enjoyed the experience.
Me too, yeah.
And I think one might expect, you know, 9 Love Shacks, which I think would be a bit much. So there's, I think this album ends up working on multiple levels. It's not just a dance record. You know, there's other things you can kind of sink into. There's some not quite melancholy, but maybe more reflective moments and stuff like that, that kind of make it a full listening experience, not just a dance record.
But all of it elicits joy or acceptance, yeah, or something positive. There's a positivity throughout the whole thing.
Yes.
That isn't cheesy, even though, my God, it couldn't be cheesier, but somehow it's genuine. And it's these people just letting their freak flags fly and being themselves. And I think there's something to be said for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, overall, to describe the album, I'll give my clickbait headline: Art Pop Meets Southern Charm. Cosmic Thing was the funky, flashy, feel-good album of 1989. It's kind of like Southern pop art, you know, like from the 60s, the Andy Warhol Collective. It's the 80s and early 90s version of that in some ways, yeah. I feel. There's that kind of thumbing your nose at society and culture, but embracing it at the same time, which is...
Yeah. There's a friendliness to it,
yes,
that the Warhol stuff and the, you know, doesn't have. It's a little Southern hospitality,
yes,
I guess.
Yes, it's the Southern part. But it's funky and quirky, and it has just this undercurrent of resilience, and it's kind of... Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot.
Right. And, you know, we talk about our killer to filler ratio. I always think these albums are strong, it seems, but because... The track listing, it's set up in such a way that, you know, it gives you breaks from, you know, the overt dance stuff,
mm-hmm,
you know, throw in some more like thoughtful tracks. So I think songs like Dry County or June Bug, you know, they kind of, you know, break up, you know, some of the...
Yeah, June Bug was kind of on my filler-ish, like my sort of question mark list of is... Fun. I like the sound of it. I like the guitar, sort of rockabilly, but the lyrics, I wasn't sure what the hell was going on. Very confusing.
Yeah, it's a little confusing. And then at one point, I'm like, oh, maybe they're literally talking about a June bug and not a metaphor. But
I suppose. But, and Bushfire, I thought was a little whatever. Deadbeat Club, I really, really liked.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's a kind of looking back at Athens, Georgia youth culture. It's kind of like the Losers Club, you know, from things, you know, from It. It feels like this bonding of these kids that were considered outcasts but found each other. And Topaz, I love the sound of it. I'm not quite sure what it's about.
Yeah, I think it's just more kind of joy and... or, you know, finding pleasure.
But Topaz is like a jewel or something, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure what the... Or, I don't know. Maybe they're talking about the earth. I'm not really sure. Okay. But it just seems like a kind of a joyful record. And it's kind of nice coming out of Channel Z where you're, you know, kind of asked to think about the darker parts of life.
It's sort of swirly. It almost made me think of some of those cinematic 60s ballady, you know, I don't know how to describe it, but there was something nostalgic about it.
Yeah.
So we talked a little bit about production stuff already. Anything to add there, Don, in terms of the production of this album?
No, other than, you know, just it's kind of surprising, you know, that like Love Shack was actually Don Was and not,
right.
and not Nile Rodgers. But no, I mean, I think it's really well done. I mean, the vocals and the harmonies are, you know, really... I mean, you can enjoy those and just focus on the harmonies and stuff like that. I feel like it's presenting them in kind of the ultimate way.
I think it's got the slick pop sheen without stripping away their, you know, the band's weird charm and their personalities and their whole vibe. But it's just like they blended new wave funk and radio friendly pop. Like, I don't know how they did it, but they did it.
Yeah.
It's a true gem, a topaz, if you will.
There you go. I think it is, yeah. They were pantyhose, too. I think they were topaz pantyhose.
Let's not talk about that. What are you talking about pantyhose for? replayability, Don, I don't even think I need to ask you this, but is this something you're going to listen to more?
Yes. And as I said before, I think it's, you know, whatever mood you're in, I think it can be, you know, a good soundtrack.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, there might be times where you don't want to hear Love Shack, but I feel like the other tracks can kind of, you know, maybe catch you.
Depends on where you are in life. If you're our age and experienced this in the 80s, maybe a nostalgia trip or just some feel-good vibes. If you're new to it, just pure fun, new things to discover. Love Shack wouldn't be boring. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be repetitive. Yeah, and that's, you know, this is all coming from a first-time listener like you as well. So I'll continue to listen to this and happily do so. See if I can find a copy on vinyl or something.
And then, I mean, the legacy. I mean, Love Shack is such a big record, and it, like I said, it shows up in weddings and you know, wherever you are. I'm not sure where to put, where to, how to categorize the B-52s. They are kind of their own thing, even mm-hmm. though they are punk and party, and but they're, you know, they're kind of a unique brand.
Yeah,
you know,
they're one of George's most unique exports, I would say.
Ooh, I like that. Yeah. And then I think, I mean, maybe there's something to be said for like a flamboyant character like Fred Schneider existing like at the same time as people like George Michael are in the closet.
Yes. And, yeah. He definitely, it was, you know, there was no doubt that he was out, and that was refreshing at that time. It mm-hmm. took a lot of guts to do that. Yeah. While REM gave Athens, Georgia, that indie cred, the B-52s kind of gave it camp and color. And I think their eccentricity embodies Georgia's creative underground. You know, like there are what would be considered weirdos everywhere. It doesn't matter what state of the union you're in. They found each other and found a way to communicate it and share it with the world. So good on them.
It is cool how these southern states all have like a college town, you know, where this kind of thing is happening.
Yep.
Right. The B-52's Cosmic Thing endures as a joyful, defiant celebration of life and creativity, radiating the infectious energy and unique spirit that define the B-52s. Check it out.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
It's time again for Deep Questions by Don. Of course, we are in the Deep South.
That's true.
We talked about cosmic things. What are some other cool things that you can find from Georgia?
One thing I ran across that I wasn't expecting, the foam finger, you know, from sporting events. Gerald Faust invented the iconic foam finger in Waycross, Georgia in 1971. However, I have read that there were other people involved. An Iowa high school student, is Steve Chimler, created the first giant hand prototype in 71. And I guess it became popularized in the late 70s.
Wow. Are there like lawsuits going on?
I don't know. I don't know.
It is. I've always enjoyed the foam finger for some reason. they've gotten smaller over the years. They're not as much fun.
God. So many places to go, and my brain is on fire right now. Also, just quickly, for me, from childhood, I just have to mention the Dukes of Hazzard aired on CBS from 79 to 85 about Bo and Luke Duke driving their car, the General Lee, getting chased by the cops. I guess they couldn't leave the county because they were charged with moonshine smuggling. Yeah. So that's why they're always in the same town, running from the same cops, jumping their car over the same barns. But I loved it. And they said yeehaw a lot. Yes. What about you, Don?
Well, I'll start with a classic beverage, Coca-Cola. Yeah, so Coca-Cola was invented in 1886 by Dr. John Stith Pemberton, a pharmacist in Atlanta, Georgia. First served at Jacob's Pharmacy. So the, you know, supposedly in the early days it had actual cocaine in it. You know, I try not to drink a lot of soda or pop, you know,
depending on where you live, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, when I do, I drink Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, I guess sticking with things that are bad for you, but got to talk about some food.
Me want food!
Waffle House. You ever been to a Waffle House?
I have not. No. I mean, I've had waffles at various breakfast joints, but no Waffle House.
Yeah, but Waffle House is this weird sort of, It almost feels kind of fast foody, you know, the way it's like kind of set up. I don't think we have many in New York, but, you know, whenever I'm in the South or in Ohio, I think you can find some Waffle Houses. It's a unique experience. All right. Well, what's your favorite thing from Georgia? Let us know on our social media, like Instagram and Facebook at Album Nerds.
So landing about as far from the B-52s as possible. I mean, there's a lot of places we could have gone, hip hop and elsewhere, but I like to get my metal in if I can. And we're going to talk about Mastodon, named after Don. Mastodon was formed in Atlanta, Georgia in the year 2000 by Troy Sanders on bass and vocals, Brent Hines on guitar and vocals, Bill Kelleher on guitar, and Brand Daler on drums and vocals. Known for blending sludge, progressive rock, heavy metal into these dense conceptual albums. And each album, and the first few of them, explored the elements like Remission, explored fire. Leviathan, their second album, explored water. Blood Mountain explored earth. And today we'll be talking about Crack the Sky from 2009. And that talks about the fifth element, ether. In the Greek mythology, it's pure fresh air or clear sky, the pure essence that the gods breathe, but it also is viewed as spirit. So Crack the Sky is a concept piece centered on astral travel, historical mysticism, and personal grief. I mean, the story's pretty in-depth, like too in-depth in some ways and too many details, but a quadriplegic boy transcends his body to journey across dimensions and ends up touching on Tsarist Russia and Rasputin and wormholes, and it's a lot. Recorded with producer Brendan O'Brien, it marries polished production with heavy progressive riffing and emotionally rich themes, but its emotional heart lies as a tribute to Brand Daler, the drummer's sister, Sky, whose passing deeply influenced him and the album's tone and title. This happened when they were teenagers, and he's kind of facing it down for the first time in this album. So why don't we kick it off with the opening track, Oblivion.
Is that Layne Staley?
I believe that part is Brent Hines. But yeah, the three voices make it interesting to try to figure out who's doing what. Mm-hmm. But Oblivion opens the story, introducing a quadriplegic boy's first astral journey. And there's this whole thing about a golden umbilical cord. Like, there's a lot going on. And there's winding riffs and layered guitars, haunting choruses. There are three vocalists on this particular one. But the lyrics kind of reference Daler's emotional journey, including an attempt apparently to literally dig to his sister after her passing. I guess he said that he tried to bore a hole into the ground. Comes from a traumatic real event after Sky died. He took LSD at her grave and tried to dig through the earth to reach her, probably, you know, having an emotional breakdown. Jesus. Yeah. So really, I think this album is about Sky and dealing with it. And the story is a way to travel through those emotions. Mm-hmm. What were your impressions at the beginning here?
Yeah. You know, there's kind of two different ways to experience the album, I think. So, I mean, you could just treat it as like any metal
cool
record
sounding.
That's
yeah.
loud and, you know, kind of, you know, makes you feel a certain way. And then
a little progressive.
Right. And then there's the, you know, the progressive aspect with the storytelling. I mean, I like both aspects of it. I think the album's a winner on both ends. I mean, I think the first thing you experience is just the music and the feel. And yeah, it just, you know, sounds great throughout. And then, you know, after a while, I think that's when you try to, you know,
right.
You dig into the lyrics and try to figure out what's going on. I mean, I don't think this is, you know, without some explanation, you know, without reading about it beforehand, I'm not sure I'd ever get it.
Right. There's no way you'd pick up on all this stuff where you'd be like, oh, Rasputin has made an appearance, who's like a whole nother historical figure from Russia that I don't even want to get too into, but it's like heavy metal literature. It's like the next step up from what Metallica was doing, where they would make references to mythical creatures and books and stories, but this takes it the next step.
Yeah.
All right, well, why don't we continue our journey through this album? And I chose the track Crack the Sky. Hmm. So we're introduced to yet another vocalist on this one. The song is the emotional bullseye, I think, of this album. It is more direct homage to Daler's sister, Skye. They brought in a friend of the band, Scott Kelly, from the band Neurosis.
Oh.
This one is probably one of the most direct because I feel like it circumvents the story a little bit, and I kind of like that.
Yeah, I like the vocals on it a lot. I mean, I particularly like the melody, you know, for the, you know, the hook there that you played. They actually, I mean, they do a good job throughout the album, you know, presenting you with just a little bit of a melody that can kind of stick in your head. You know, it's not just, you know, sludge and thrash.
Very atmospheric, this one.
Yep.
Very heaven and hell.
Some space rock.
Yeah, kinda. It's just such a different experience than the B-52's record.
Yeah.
This was a weird week in that way, going from this hard rocking dirge to also people dealing with loss though, right? But mm-hmm. in a very different way.
Yeah.
All right, Don, I'm going to let you take the lead. What song you want to dig into?
Yeah, well, I picked one of the long ones.
Of course.
So the song The Czar. Yeah, so it's actually a kind of a four-part suite of songs, Usurper, Escape, Martyr, and Spiral. So I think this part here is from Usurper.
I think that's Brent. Very Ozzy-ish at times.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That little part there just like stayed in my head all week. I just kept walking around the house all day. It's your own fault. You know, I like the vocal treatments on the album. Although I at times think it does make it harder to decipher the lyrics. You know, I guess which can be a problem if you're trying to do some storytelling. But I think the vocal effects really blend well with the music and give it that kind of atmospheric and sort of dreamlike feel.
Yeah.
But this Czar suite here basically is the Rasputin story. So he ends up, you know, basically being, you know, leaping into Rasputin, like a almost like Quantum Leap. Remember that show?
Yes. Putting right what once went wrong.
Yes, exactly. But anyway, yeah, kind of, you know, there's some haunting church organ in the song, which I think gives it sort of that, you know, that religious vibe, you know, which makes sense.
Yeah, Rasputin, just briefly, was a controversial Russian mystic and faith healer who, because of his quote-unquote powers, worked his way into the, you know, leadership, the politics, and there was an assassination attempt and that failed, and another one. I mean, he was a dangerous figure depending on what side of Russian politics at the time you were on. So it's just Mastodon showing how smart they are and how much they've read and how little I know because I have to look up everything.
Yeah, I think he was assassinated by actual like nobility because they saw him as like an intruder on that.
Maybe a usurper.
Yes.
I mean, I just feel like such a dummy digging into some of this.
Right. But we're so much smarter now having listened to it and looked it all up.
We learn things. They should really just include a giant book with this. Mm. But yeah, it shifts through movements though. You know, there's doom, there's prog, there's sludge, there's psychedelic moments. And lyrically, I just think betrayal and assassination and spiritual journeys are really what you can take from it as a part of that story. And maybe all of this is around Bran imagining that his sister's spirit is traveling through the ether. You know, I feel like it all ties back to that. And his friends, his bandmates, helped him take that journey and face this finally in his life.
Yeah, I think Rasputin was actually, I think he ended up like doing some healing or something. And so like, I wonder if he's almost like turning to a character like him to, you know, maybe bring back his sister or something.
So many potentialities and so many threads that this album can open up. Why don't we close it out with The Last Baron, another long one.
Yeah.
We're talking 50 minutes, 7 tracks here. So. Probably one of their most ambitious compositions at 13 minutes. It's constantly shifting from heavy sludge riffs to airy psychedelic passages, jagged, even sort of math rock breaks. Think of it as Mastodon's answer to Rush or King Crimson. but still rooted in their foundations. This one ties directly into the album's concept, where the Baron acts as a final guardian, possibly linked to Rasputin, but it's still cryptic at the same time. I mean, there's these sections, like the first 3 minutes or so is more like strange rhythms and riffing. The middle movements are more expansive and trippy. The final build has a lot of crescendo to it. It closes out the album with a bang, but a cosmic exhale, leaving me both exhausted and awestruck. What were your thoughts on The Last Baron?
Yeah, I like it. I got to say, though, like most of the time when I was listening to this, I wasn't paying attention to the tracks. Like at time, you know, I wasn't quite sure like where the song began, because it really flows well with the rest of the album. I don't think they actually repeat any of the themes from other songs, but it does kind of feel like they are wrapping
connected,
it all up.
Yeah,
yeah, it's really a good ending. Mm-hmm. It's like the opposite of an overture.
Yeah.
Whatever you call that. I'm sure there's a musical term for what I'm trying to describe, but it just kind of reminds you of everything you experienced so far. And I'm not sure if it's resolution, but it's like the story ends for now or something.
Yeah.
Well, great track.
This is, I feel like there's just not enough time. We'd need like a 3-hour podcast to really dig into the story and all the details and songs and. But let's take what we've got and rewind and reflect on this album as a whole. Overall vibe, we'll jump into first, and I'll start with my clickbait headline. From Atlanta to the astral plane, crack the sky as Mastodon's mind-bending masterclass in Sledge Prog and Facing Loss. I really think it was mostly about facing loss. Dark and progressive. It's an emotional, it's a masterpiece as far as I'm concerned. I don't know if it's my personal favorite album, but of Mastodon's, but it's big. And knowing what this is really about, someone's decades-long pain, and then those crushing riffs and psychedelic passages, cohesive, moving, and heavy, it carries that weight, that pain, well. So overall, it blows my mind. How about you, Don?
That's it. Well, I'll start with my clickbait headline. Mastodon cracks the sky and your mind on a prog metal journey with everyone's favorite Russian mystic. I don't know any other Russian mystics, so I guess Rasputin's my favorite.
Yeah, there you go.
So this is my first personal experience with Mastodon. I've heard you and Andy talk about them, on past episodes. But yeah, I mean, I was into this record, you know, right from the beginning. It kind of makes me sad about like the current state of Metallica. Not that I hate Metallica now or anything, but these guys sort of have, and maybe it's just because I'm less familiar with them, but they have sort of an aura of mystery and
they're from a different era,
darkness.
Though. Yeah.
I don't know. There's something intimidating about them, I think, that I used to feel that way about Metallica, and now I don't. But it could just be familiarity.
It is. It's largely familiarity, and it's a different time. You know, these guys came along in 2000, not 1982. You know, there was what was dangerous musically in 1982 is very different from now.
Yeah.
Or from 20 years ago.
Clearly, I mean, these guys couldn't exist without Metallica and what Metallica did before. But I wish current Metallica sounded more like this.
Well, then go listen. Forget Metallica. Go listen to the rest of the Mastodon records, dude.
I will. I like progressive rock. And, you know, I've warmed to metal over the years. So this is, you know, just a perfect blend for me. Really well done.
Yeah. I mean, there's only 7 songs, so killer to filler ratio. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, depending on your taste, it's either all killer or all filler. None of these songs exist without the rest. Divinations is a little thrashier. I like that one. Quintessence, which is another word for the ether, apparently, is epic and cosmic. And then Ghost of Karelia is kind of a little more haunting. Very intricate. I mean, I assume you're on the same page as me with this.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, listening to it, you know, without looking at the, you know, at my phone or whatever, like I didn't necessarily know when tracks ended and when they began. And what was the record? Oh, was it the Ben Folds, where originally they weren't going to have any, you know, tracks at all? I think this is an album where it could just be one track. Yeah.
Production wise, I really don't even know what to say. It's the cleanest Mastodon had sounded up to this point, I think. Still thunderous. That happens when you get a big, you know, name like Brendan O'Brien, who, you know, to create clarity without sacrificing heaviness. And you need clarity with all this detail.
I know O'Brien's a big name. What else has he done?
AC/DC, Pearl Jam, The Offspring, Stone Temple Pilots, Soundgarden, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Rage Against the Machine, Bruce Springsteen, Korn, Limp Bizkit. I mean, he's been all over the place.
I guess that's an okay resume.
Yeah. Replayability, for me, obviously very high. It's a heavier lift than our B-52's experience, and it isn't casual. But if I'm looking for to have a little more fun with Mastodon, I'm probably going with Leviathan, which is about Moby Dick, which is still pretty deep stuff. But and some of the newer ones are less conceptual. They're conceptual, but a little more varied in sound. So there's a lot to experience. But if I feel like cracking my brain, I'll crack the sky too.
I mean, I listen to this a lot, and I still don't feel that comfortable talking about it.
I don't get it.
I get it in term, like I enjoy it, but I feel like I definitely need to experience it more. So I am going to spend a lot of time with it. But then, like, I also know, I mean, there's a whole Mastodon catalog that I need to explore. So do I stick with this?
I think you start from the beginning, and then when you get through all of them, you can go back to this one.
Okay.
I listen to all their albums over the course of the week because I love them. Okay, so the legacy of this album, I mean, it's often cited as Mastodon's artistic peak, kind of solidifying them as one of the most important modern metal bands, certainly of their times. The themes are, as we talked about, varied, they're deep, they're painful, they're fantastical. And as far as Georgia goes, Mastodon put Atlanta firmly on the global metal map.
Yeah. So I don't know a lot about like the current state of metal, but I have to think a record like this.
It's very fractured.
Yeah.
Lots of subgenres. And this is a little more unifying because it just covers so much.
Okay. I mean, I would think an album like this is responsible for a lot of groups deciding to be metal bands, mm-hmm. you know, because they're really, I guess, took the baton from, you know, all the bands from the 80s and 90s and are keeping it going. Along with, what was the other prog album? The Sword.
The Sword. Yeah. They're from Texas.
Oh, that's right.
So from Atlanta's heavy roots to cosmic metal heights, Mastodon's Crack the Sky is a journey through grief, myth, and sheer sonic power. Check it out.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Right, well, I've been burying myself in some peach cobbler all week. That sounds kind of bad, too.
burying yourself in peach cobbler.
Did you have a chance to dig anything else this week?
I did. And now I've got this horrible image in my head. So yeah, Charlie Crockett, once again.
Charlie Crockett. Well,
supposedly he's related to Davy Crockett, distant relatives. And his 16th studio album in 10 years, Jesus. Dollar a Day.
It's got to be a record.
I know. He's sort of like King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard, the country, the country world. He's a Texas-born singer-songwriter. He blends neo-traditional country, blues, Americana, and Southern soul. Recently signed with Island Records, which I think he was more independent before then. This one is the second in a 3-album trilogy, released August 8th, 2025. Why don't we jump in with a little bit of Dollar a Day?
Cowboys and money, no mix, can't you see? Mean only briefly than part company.
So lots of Western imagery. Smoky tales of cowboys, heartbreak, survival, solitude. Yeah, I just love this guy. And he just continues to crank out quality stuff. They're simple songs, but they're always moving and fun and interesting. So I love recommending him, but such a vast catalog. It's like, where do you begin?
Well, now that he's got the Island Def Jam promotional power behind him, maybe he'll get a guest spot.
Crossover, hip-hop stuff.
I was going to say Yellowstone or something.
Yellowstone's over, my friend, but there's some spinoffs coming. Additionally, I like to feature an album that I recently added to my collection or sometimes something I've gone back to. Just picked up a few weeks ago, Men at Work, Business as Usual. You remember that one?
Yes.
Melbourne, Australia quartet formed in the early 80s with Colin Hay on vocals and guitar. I think
it must have been tough as a kid. It would be like, Colin Hay, Colin High, Colin, how you doing?
Yeah. It has this sort of new wave, reggae rock, pop sound. I always kind of thought of it as the international Huey Lewis in the News.
I guess who can it be now because of the saxophone? It does sound kind of Huey Lewis. I never thought of that. I could actually hear him singing that now, too.
Wow. Who Can It Be Now is one of my favorites, but let's listen to a little bit of one of the more quirky songs, Down Under. Because I come from the land of plenty. Also, the first time I ever heard of anything about a Vegemite sandwich. Yep. I had to ask around a lot. No one knew what the hell that was in my part of the country, the Midwest.
Have you tried it?
I have not.
Oh, it's interesting.
I bet it is.
It's very salty. Very, very salty.
So Down Under is obviously reggae influenced. It's sort of an anthem celebrating Australian identity, critiquing it too. Got that flute. One thing with Who Can It Be Now, I always loved when it's Who Can It Be knocking at my door, and they took the drum, dun, 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 like it was knocking on the door. As a kid, I thought that was really awesome. But, you know, I just have an 80s copy of this. It costs like under $10. It's nothing fancy, but it's really fun to just have it on vinyl and play it the way God intended. So, yeah, it's fun. I'm happy to have it. What about you, Donnie boy?
Well, I was digging into, you know, some of the things Tidal recommends for me. So I found an artist named Coley Kennedy. He's a Michigan-based singer-songwriter, also a photographer. He was in bands Welcome to Ashley, The Buddies, and Black Vincent. I'm not familiar with any of them, but kind of a British post-punk, maybe a little 50s rockabilly, some indie. The album's called Neptune Blue, and here's the title track.
You know, I currently am not a Tidal subscriber just because I already have two others, but their recommendations are better than the rest, and they nailed it on you there, Don.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They know me pretty well. Okay, and then another band, it's been around for a while, Pile. Have you heard of Pile?
I have.
Boston-based indie rock band. It was basically a solo project of a guy named Rick McGuire, but it's, you know, become more of a collective now, known for experimental guitar work, raw, weird vocals, kind of folk punk.
Okay.
Anyway, new album's called Sunshine and Balance Beams. And here's the opening cut called An Opening.
I like it.
Yeah, that opening cut is kind of all over the place, you know. It's very kind of progressive, you know, in the way that it changes melodies and, you know, just changes sonically.
I think folk punk, like you said, is, at least for this track, it works.
Yeah, I've seen people use the term post-rock, not totally sure what that means.
Yeah, that little bit also had some Nirvana energy.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. All right. Well, what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky. Also, don't forget to dig on some other music podcasts like Astrovert. The Astrovert podcast is hosted by Mike and Jake. They discuss the journey of their band Astroverts while covering news and releases from, you know, underground artists and hardcore and screamo and all that stuff. So check out the Astrovert podcast wherever you find podcasts.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Here we are again. It's about time on the show when I'm reminded of the words sung by Sir Ray Charles.
Has he been knighted?
Should have been. Georgia, a song of you comes as sweet and clear as moonlight through the pines. Other arms reach out to me, other eyes smile tenderly. Still, in the peaceful dreams, I see the road leads back to you.
Oof.
That's perfect for, you know, ending our Bands Across America tour. But summer's not quite over yet. The road trip continues. We've decided to head north, the Great White North, Canada, and see if we can find some fun music to talk about to close out this mega road trip we took.
So it's Bands Across North America.
Sure, yes. So yeah, there's so much good music up in Canada, so no problem there.
All right, well, what's your favorite record from the Great White North? What else are you listening to? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com or follow us on Instagram and other social media at Album Nerds. and visit albumnerds.com to listen to all 304 episodes. And the best way to support this show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you, as always, for joining us on the Album Nerds podcast. We'll catch you next time, freezing our asses off in Canada.
I got me a podcast. It's as big as a whale. <I don't know.
laughs> You had a week to think about this.
I know. I need to take it more seriously.
Yes.
Album Nerds, baby!
You've been driving your wife nuts with that all week?
Yes.
Poor woman.
Take out the garbage!
Okay. see you next time.